Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, it's time for the Negative Positives Podcast, coming to you live out of the Gutter Man Cave in beautiful Louisville, Kentucky. And now, here are your hosts, Andre Dominguez and Mike Gutterman.
Hello, and welcome to the Negative Positives Podcast, episode number 143. I'm your host, Mike Gutterman, again, coming to you from a sweltering, hot, sticky Gutterman cave. And this is the midweek episode, even though we record these on Mondays. And when I say we, it's because everyone's favorite co-captain has joined us again tonight. And it's always nice when Andre can join us for the midweek episode. So here he is, folks. Everyone's favorite co-captain, Andre Dominguez. How are you tonight, Andre?
I'm doing well, Mike. It is so nice now in this wonderful summer. I won't say vacation given the amount of work, but this summer period to be able to record with you twice a week and to be on every episode of the podcast, because I think our audiences can agree that every episode with the both of us is always wonderful.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I'll give it to you. I'll give you some credit. You've elevated quality of this program. And speaking of quality, I think, Andre, that we are finally over our shitty sound quality issues. I think we might got to figure it out. I don't know. What do you think?
I think so too. I went ahead and listened back to the Sunday night, Monday morning episode with John Gregory, and both of our audios sound nice and crisp and clear. We've escaped the tin can that we were recording in previously, the metal bathroom that Mike had us locked in for all eternity. He's finally kind of, you know, living up to his musician chops and getting our audio to where it needs to be.
Well, I got to say, as a musician for a lot of years, I'm pretty sure my hearing is not what it used to be. So I'm about half deaf at this point. So maybe that was the problem. But okay, so we're going to start out the show just kind of doing a little update on what we've been up to before we get into some heavy hot meats of this of the film world. And so Andre, why don't you start off with kind of what you've been up to that we haven't really been able to talk about when we have guests on the show?
Yeah, I mean, little things that I've just been working at CineStill. I did manage to red scale the Fujifilm Superior 400 that Mike sent me in the CineStill darkroom, which was actually a lot of fun and less difficult than I thought it was going to be, given that at CineStill, inside of the darkroom, they have an infrared lamp and these like night vision goggles. So just kind of pulling all the film off of the reels and being able to see which side was the emulsion side was great, because then I was able to just tape those onto the center spools of those plastic reloadable film cassettes and then just wind them back in. So I now have four hand rolled cassettes of red scaled film that I will probably be using the first roll just to kind of bracket the exposures, because you're sort of shooting through the film base when you're shooting red scale film. They always say that you want to kind of overexpose the film, but the more you overexpose it, the less red it looks. So you, mm-hmm. what you gain in tonality, you lose in the sort of iconic redness of how the final image looks. So what I'm probably going to do is bracket the exposures, shoot one roll at one shot at 400, the next shot at 200, the next shot at 100, the next shot at 50. And just do that consistently for a test roll to see where I kind of want to rate this film going forward, because there is still a decent amount of Superior 400 on the market. And if I do end up liking the results of the red-scaled film, I may stoop to the level of buying a little bit and just kind of keeping it on ice for whenever I do want to have some red scale results, because I don't really want to buy like Portra or Ektar, which is not inexpensive, yeah, just to red scale it. I'd want to buy like cheap stuff.
Yeah, I mean, when I bought this film from the very famous Walmart clearance, I actually put on the Facebook group, I was like, what the hell am I going to do with all this Fuji film? Because I've made no bones about it. I'm not a huge Fuji film fan, but you know, it was a cheap price, and I knew buying it that I wanted to do more experimental stuff with it, or just use it for like testing cameras, or you know, kind of non-essential stuff or whatever. And somebody had mentioned on the Facebook group, hey, red scale it, and I was like, oh, that's a great idea. So I like the idea. I think basically all the Fuji film that I bought from the Walmart clearance that I haven't already given away, because I've given some away already to Andre and to Sherry Christensen. I sent her some for sending me that Kodak Pony camera, and to give a little thank you to her. And but the stuff I have left of the Fuji Walmart clearance, I think I'm going to red scale it as well. I was thinking of actually just using the same canister and just, you know, pulling it out in the dark bag, flipping it and taping it to, you know, a little end of the film reel or whatever. But you actually just loaded it into your little plastic reusable cartridges, is that right?
Yeah, the reason why I ended up doing that, I thought about just, you know, using the same cartridges, but then I'd have to use, you know, a very sort of thin, clear, like normal Scotch tape. Mm-hmm. And whereas I could accurately, you know, line up the film perfectly, given that when I'm there in the darkroom with the night vision goggles, I can see exactly what I'm doing. But those reloadable cartridges that I use for bulk loading always has a piece of gaffer tape on the center spool anyway. So whenever I'm just done with a roll of film, I just kind of, you know, take it off of whatever little snipped piece was from the last part and just put on a new one. So I kind of just wanted it to be easier that way. And also if I do, the whole DX coding thing doesn't matter if I am kind of bracketing the shots and using a camera that you set the ISO manually. But yeah, I mean, you could do either way. I just chose to do it with the reloadable cassettes, mm-hmm, because reasons.
Yeah, I think I'm going to try to use those Fuji cassettes, I think. I think I'm going to just try to flip it and tape it to the end, I guess. I think that's what I'm going to try, but I may get frustrated and just bring out some of my... I bought like 30 of these Kodak manufactured from the, I don't know when they made these things, but they're called I think snap caps or something. Like, they're plastic refillable cartridges, 35 millimeter cartridges made by Kodak. And there was a guy on eBay selling them pretty cheap, so I bought like 30 of those. So I still have quite a bit of those. I may end up doing that, because it might make it a little simpler. I definitely use those for when I do bulk loading, but I don't know. I'll see what I'm going to do. So the way I understand red scale, and I haven't tried it yet, is it's probably not going to... I sent you 400 speed film, is that right?
Yeah.
So you're probably going to overexpose more than anything, I guess. But I guess, like you said, the more underexposed, the more red, and the more overexposed, the more it leans toward like orange or something like that. Am I correct?
Yeah, it gets closer and closer to like quote unquote normal looking.
Okay.
So the more underexposed, so the closer to the box speed that you shoot it at, the much like kind of darker red color you have, but you have much, you know, limited, much more limited tonality and dynamic range. Mm. The closer, the more and more you overexpose it, so the closer I would, for example, shoot it towards like ISO 50, ISO 25, the more tonality and dynamic range you'd get, but it would start to look lighter, lighter orange to the point where it's almost kind of like sort of sepia looking. So what I want to do is essentially just to find, through that bracketing process, find at what, where I want to rate it depending on the results that I want. If there is a shot that I want a little bit more tonality, then I know that I can just over or under expose it by a certain amount. And if I see a scene where I'm like, oh, I want this red as hell, I can, you know, rate it at like, let's say 400 or 200. So,
yeah.
And you could do that with any film that you want to red scale. One thing that I'm actually considering is, I'm obviously going to be using these four rolls that Mike sent me, but afterwards, if I want to support Kodak, maybe try it out the same thing, try it out with a roll of Kodak Gold and Ultramax, things that, you know, are in current production, are going to remain hopefully in current production, and that I can support Kodak with, and see the same process, the same bracketing thing with the Kodak films, the cheaper Kodak films, and see, okay, let's say that I really like how Kodak Gold at, you know, 100 or 50 looks, and that's sort of my my standard baseline for red scaling Kodak Gold. And with that, you can, as I mentioned, under overexpose as you like to get the look that you want depending on the scene.
Nice, nice. Yeah, there's also the Kodak Color Plus, which is really, really cheap film. I've got quite a few rows of that. I need to shoot that really soon and see how I like it, because it's like, it's actually the cheapest Kodak film. And even though it's not actually supposed to be available in the USA, like B&H and Adorama and all those major places sell it, but I think it's actually not supposed to be sold in the US market, but it's available online everywhere. But I think I bought mine from Amazon. If you're looking for really cheap Kodak film, the Color Plus, I hear a lot of good stuff about it and a lot of bad stuff about it, but apparently it's like an older emulsion, an older version of like Kodak Gold or something. And when you pull out the Color Plus reel, the cassette out of the plastic container, it has a very old school, like, I don't know, early 90s, kind of late 80s kind of graphic design on it. Looks like they didn't even change the graphics from back then. So it definitely seems like it's possibly an older emulsion, but I kind of dig the retro graphics on it. But have you any experience with Color Plus, Andre?
No, I really don't. I don't have experience with really any of the kind of the cheaper consumer level Kodak films. I do want to, you know, explore them a little bit, especially for, you know, these kinds of reasons, for testing film, for red scaling, and just replace, you know, Superia and other cheaper stocks that I used to do this stuff with, so that at least these little experiments that I have, I can do that while supporting Kodak.
Yeah, I like it. So anything else that you had happen this week, or do I need to move on to my agenda?
I think let's move on to you. The other CineStill stuff is going to be for the next section about some film news.
Yeah, big news, big news. So as far as me, I have my my art show that I've done a lot of talking about coming up this Saturday, and I'm getting ready for it. And I thought I was way ahead of the game. This weekend, I had to buy like a 10 by 10 foot pop-up tent, because all the artists are required to have like tents, and plus it's going to be hot as hell and the sun's going to be beaming on us, so you'd probably want one anyway. But so I had to like buy this tent, and I set it up, and I was like, okay, now how am I gonna build walls and hang photos inside this pop-up tent? And so I think I got it figured out. I posted a photo on the Facebook group, kind of showed kind of how I'm approaching it in a kind of a half-assed way so far. But the big thing after I get done podcasting is I had a bunch of stuff framed for this, and I left all these framed photos in my garage in the heat, and probably shouldn't have done that, but my thought was, well, this is going to be an outside art show. They're going to be in the heat anyway, so maybe bringing them into air conditioning and then going to the art show and bringing them out in the heat, that temperature change could cause problems. So I was like, well, let me just leave them in the garage in the heat, and then when I go to the art show, they'll be in heat still, and there won't be this temperature change or whatever. But something happened over the last week or two, and some of them, the inside of the glass of the frame has fogged up pretty bad. And so unfortunately I have a lot of work ahead of me, because I'm going to have to unframe these things, clean the glass again, and reframe them. And it's really bothering me. And I've had this problem many times in the past, usually in art shows, outside art shows, where the weather is quite hot, it seems, when I have this trouble. And I know that some people say these are inkjet prints, and generally what they tell you is, when you print an inkjet print, basically you kind of want to let the print air out or dry for at least 24 hours before you frame it, because there's this off-gassing from the print inks, printer inks. And if you put it into a frame too soon, the off-gassing will fog the glass. The only thing I can think of, I definitely gave all these prints, you know, at least 24 hours, sometimes 48 hours, sometimes a week before I put them in frames. But the only thing I can think of is maybe the heat has caused them to off-gas more than they normally would, and that's what's fogged up the frames, fogged up the glass. So I'm not sure. If anyone has any sort of information on why I'm experiencing this problem, I would love to know, because I've been fighting this for, I don't know, 13, 14 years now, but not quite this bad. So, yeah, it's not all of them fogged up. So I'm still a little ahead of the game, but I've got some more work ahead of me that I didn't think I would have to do. I don't know, Andre, you have any thoughts? Does my theory sound like that might be what I'm dealing with?
I mean, I think so. I don't really have much experience at all with inkjet printing. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I'm not even sure whether or not, like, storing the frame prints in your house would be a good idea, because imagine on Saturday, on the day of the actual art fair, you take them from your air-conditioned house outside, they just fog up instantly anyway. And then you have fog prints as you're sort of driving to the art fair. I'm not sure what the best solution is.
I'm not sure either. I really thought the smart play was going to leave them out here in the heat. And it's not every one of them. That's a strange thing. And I don't know, maybe some of the, I wonder, I probably should look to see if it's more like the color prints fogging or the black and whites. I'm not, or if there's just, if it's just random. It's really weird. But at any rate, I've got a little bit of a setback, but I'll be ready. I've got some time. So once we get done with this podcast, I'll be up till 6 or 7 in the morning trying to straighten this shit out. anyway, that's about the high. Oh, I did get a little package in the mail today, and from the FPP. I got 3 rows of Kodak T-Max 3200, because the FPP put them on sale for like last week for like, I think it was like $7.49 a roll or something, so I couldn't pass that up. And so I bought 3 rows of it. And it's funny, when I placed the order, I jumped on it pretty quick when they put them on sale, but they had already sold out of them, and I had to wait for another shipment to come in for them. So I think it's a good sign that this T-Max 3200 is selling quite well. And I also threw in a row of an FPP hand-rolled film, the Kodak, I think it's 5363. It's like the high contrast black and white film, 25 ISO. I haven't tried that one yet. So, you know, I was like, what the heck? Go ahead and throw that in there too, and have another weird experimental film to you know, give a try to. But yeah, always nice to get a package in the mail from the mighty FPP. So that was exciting.
Definitely, yeah. Well, and, you know, that price of, you know, $7.49 is really what, you know, T-Max P3200 should be sold for, according to Kodak's suggested retail price. There definitely are some some retailers out there that have been a little
price gouging,
dare I say, greedy and price gougy in how they're choosing to price the P3200, because it really should not cost something like $10 or $11 a roll.
Yeah. I think it's they're just kind of maybe because of its popularity, they're able to get that price, so they're asking that price. But hopefully, I'd like to see that settle around the $750 range, because I have no problem paying that price for it, because I love that film. So, and you know, it is what it is. But all right, Andre, you want to take a break and then get into some big, gigantic film news that's happening and has happened?
Absolutely.
All right, well, we will take a break, folks, and we will be right back. All right, folks, we are back from our break, and there is some hot news, as hot as the Gutterman Cave. There is some film news that has come out this week, and the film world is going to be all abuzz about all this stuff. And it just so happens one of the big news items comes from a certain company that a certain co-captain might have some little ties and inside information on. After we recorded last night, I actually got a press release from Andre's company, Cinestill. And it was after we recorded with John Gregory, and we kind of joked that we weren't hip enough in the news media, apparently, to get these type things. But as soon as we got done podcasting last night, I actually got an email from Cinestill with a little press release. So that was pretty super exciting. I think I finally made it, folks. But Andre, I think I'm just going to have to turn this one over to you. This is one of your babies. So tell us about this Cinestill exciting news.
Well, thank you, Mike. It is definitely something that I have been working on for a few weeks now. Very, very tight-lipped project. I've been wanting to kind of speak about it for such a long time because I think it's so cool. I have used it myself quite a bit, but I would like to formally announce, by the time that this podcast comes out, y'all will probably have already heard about it, but for the purposes of today and talking to Mike, I'd like to formally announce the Cinestill DF96 Monobath, a super easy to use single step solution that will fully and archivally develop and fix all of your black and white needs at any room temperature of your choosing.
Wow, so the temperature is not that persnickety on this?
So if you have met the twins, Brandon and Brian Wright here at Cinestill, they definitely are persnickety, but persnickety in a good way. Persnickety in a detail-oriented, trying to make something the best that it can be and the most user-friendly as possible. The way that processing works with the DF96 Monobath is that if you have a developing tank and a thermometer, you have all that you need to develop the film. What you do is, prior to pouring the chemical into the tank, you just take a temperature reading of the chemical, and based on the temperature of the monobath, that'll dictate what is the minimum time that you are going to be processing for and what kind of agitation method you're going to be using. So for example, at around 70 degrees Fahrenheit, these are all plus or minus 2 degrees Fahrenheit, you're going to be doing very minimal agitation for at least 6 minutes. At 75 degrees Fahrenheit, plus or minus 2 degrees, you'll be doing your normal sort of intermittent agitation for at least 4 minutes. And when I say intermittent agitation, just imagine, your inversions at the first, 10 to 30 seconds, and then 4 inversions, or 10 seconds of inversions at the top of every minute. What most people are used to anyway. Nice. And then at 80 degrees Fahrenheit, it is constant agitation for at least 3 minutes. And when I say these kind of at least, 6, 4, 3 minutes, essentially you can't overdevelop the film with this monobath. At a certain point during that process, the development will be completely finished. You won't overdevelop your highlights, for example, and it'll start fixing. And that minimum time is just the minimum time that you need in order to fully develop and fix the film. And after each roll that you process, you just add 15 seconds to the processing time until you reach whatever you deem unacceptable processing times. We recommend around 8 minutes. And with a 1 liter solution, you can process 16 plus rolls of film. We've tested, you know, more than that, but that's kind of our recommendation so far. So at a retail price of $16.99, that's a hair over $1 a roll for nice. Just one chemical that you can't really overdevelop, under agitate, mess up the dilutions and all that jazz. So and the results are extremely, you know, fine grain, positive. I've been using it quite a bit these past few weeks, and it's given my HC110 a run for its money, I've got to say.
Wow. And so this is just bringing up some questions here.
Go for it. I'm here to answer them.
What about like say you push Tri-X from 400 to 1600? How does that affect like when you do push a film? Is it are those times readily available on like the info they give you, or I mean, how would you push with it? Like, does it?
So we've definitely, you know, tested out pushing and pulling. All you need to do to you know push is to adjust the processing temperature by plus or minus 10 degrees Fahrenheit per stop. So if you are using a sous vide, for example, that's super easy to do. If you want to, you know, push Tri-X to 1600, you just increase the processing temperature by 20 degrees.
Oh, wow. So that's interesting. Instead of like increasing time like you would normally do with traditional developers, when you're pushing, you're actually just increasing the temperature, but the time stays, I guess, around the same, right?
Yeah, time stays the same. You adjust the temperature, which I find really great, because if I'm pushing, you know, Tri-X two stops and developing an HC110, that's a 16 minute just for the development.
Yeah.
Not to mention, you know, around 30 seconds to a minute for the stop bath, which in this case you don't need, as well as I usually do 5 minutes of fixing. So to be able to, you know, to have around, you know, like a 5 minute complete processing time from, you know, pouring it in to pouring it out, just at a higher temperature using something like a sous vide, and still have it pushed is mm-hmm. awesome.
That is nice. And plus, I think, you know, when you talk about the, what is it, like $16 for a liter? Is that what we're looking at? About a dollar a row is what you were saying.
About a dollar a roll.
I mean, you also have to remember that's including your fixer as well. So, like, that's two chemicals being taken right. care of.
And that's also including, like, stopping the development, which not right. everybody buys chemical stop bath, but, you know, I, for example, do. So if I think about, you know, the total kind of cost per roll from, like, buying my HC110 and buying my stop bath and buying my fixer, it does end up a lot cheaper.
Nice. I like this. It's kind of intriguing me. I got to admit, Andre, and I'm not just being nice to you because you work there, but it's a very interesting thing. I'm definitely going to have to give this a try. Another question was, what was I thinking? So I guess really all you need, because technically this is going to be your developer, your stop bath, and your fixer, kind of all in one. You can't overdevelop, which is pretty cool. But so really all you need at that point, if you want, is you know, like your HypoClear and I guess PhotoFlow. If you some people go without those steps, I guess. But like I guess HypoClear would still be kind of important.
Both of which are definitely, you know, optional. Mm-hmm. We have kind of tested out what the actual sort of washing times are going to be, and they shouldn't be any without HypoClear, shouldn't be anything longer than about 5 minutes is sufficient to fully wash the film. If you want to do HypoClear, then it's even better. It's a 1 minute pre-wash, 1 minute in the HypoClear, 1 minute post-wash. Nice. As the lovely Leslie Lazenby has beautifully broken down for us all on the FPP podcast. And you know, the photo flow as well, is it depends on the hardness of your water and what kind of mineral content is in your water. There's a lot of folks that don't use photo flow at all. They just, you know, do the whole finger squeegee method, or a final rinse in distilled water. So, you know, you could, with something like the lab box, for example, just have the lab box in that case, you wouldn't even need a thermometer, because the lab box has a built-in, thermometer in the lid. Just pour it in, and then according to the temperature, just, you know, do either the continuous agitation with the crank or just the intermittent agitation for however long you need according to the temperature. Pour it back into the bottle, hang it up, well, wash it, and then hang it up to dry. So it very well could be used for sort of an on-the-go developing solution.
Nice. Yeah, I have really hard water here in Louisville, so I'll have to continue to use photo flow. And HypoClear I've always liked anyway. It's cheap enough, and it takes forever for that chemical to go bad anyway. But photo flow is cheap too, and you buy like one bottle of it, and you damn near have a 10-year supply of it. So that's nothing to be afraid of. It's definitely nothing to discourage you. You were going to need those probably anyway. I'm super excited about it, man. And so the FPP has their monobath, and they claimed it was archival. So you guys are also considering this an archival process with the negatives as well?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of misconceptions when it comes to monobaths. The folks over at the FPP have done, you know, their own extensive testing and are confident in their product. We're confident in ours as well. I think there's a very sort of bright future for monobaths in general as we move forward, not only for, you know, it being a good tool for beginners getting into film, but, you know, with the quality that you're able to get with modern monobaths, you know, there's no reason why folks couldn't use that as you know, their primary developer, or just one of the tools in their developing toolbox. I know that I don't use just one developer. I use things, you know, based on what it is that I'm shooting. I love developing low speed film in Rodinal and high speed film in HC110. Mm-hmm. Then again, if I'm in a rush or I just have one roll to do, you know, the whole process of, you know, syringing out the HC110 syrup and mixing that with water, while I'm used to it now, definitely is more time consuming, and having to deal with stop bath and fixer is all more time consuming than using something like the DF96 monobath. Nice. So, you know, you can pick and choose and see, you know, try it out. I definitely encourage everybody to try it out when it does finally hit the shelves and hit the CineStill online store. But give it a shot, see if you like it, and it very well may, you know, be incorporated as part of your toolkit moving forward.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of advantages to different developers, and I'm not an expert at it, because my developing has been basically D76 and now HC110. I did notice I shot some really, really expired film a couple months ago, and it was one of my first rolls I developed with HC110, and I had forgotten. I read this, and I'm sure most people might already know this, but it's kind of pretty known knowledge that if you're shooting really expired films where you might have a lot of base fog due to the age of the film, HC110 is really good about getting rid of that base fog. So something to think about if you're doing expired film. But I think this is going to be another awesome little solution for new people getting into film photography. But it's even for somebody like me, I feel like I'm definitely going to give it a shot, because You know, it's easy. And there's times when, you know, I've let some film build up and I've got 10 rows to try to develop in a day. And if I can cut that time down a little bit, that might be the proper solution for me. So when do you think it'll actually hit the streets?
I mean, we already have quite a bit of it in our warehouse here in LA. We dropped off a shipment at Freestyle Photo this morning, as of recording this podcast, and we should be shipping some out to our German distributor relatively soon. So y'all are going to be able to get your hands on it, you know, pretty darn soon.
This is like almost as quick as the T-Max 3200 from the announcement to the shelves. Like, you guys are getting after it. I like it. I like it. So,
yep, that's the goal.
So what? So you've done a lot of testing with it. What films have you developed in it so far?
So far, I have developed some Tri-X, HP5, obviously the CineStill BWXX, Kodak, you know, double X. Is it 5222? I believe
it
is.
Yeah, that's it.
Mm-hmm. As well as a few others, I've done a little bit of T-Max P3200. Not all of it stuff that I've shot myself, but just, mm-hmm. you know, stuff that people kind of put in a little basket at CineStill, and when I'm doing a batch, I'll just do it all at the same time. But everything that I've put through it so far has looked fantastic. The only thing that is worth consideration is the T-Max films. For some reason, not P3200, but the T-Max 100 and T-Max 400 are just going to require longer processing times to make sure that you're fully fixing it, which isn't surprising at all if you're familiar with T-Max films, yeah. That they just require more time to fully fix and get rid of those dyes, that kind of really strong purplish cast that you get on the negative if you don't fully fix it. T-Max films oftentimes have double the fixing times that something like Tri-X or HP5 have. So just a consideration. It's not that you can't use them. You just have to process for longer.
Yeah, I've always kind of overfixed, I guess, a tad bit on T-Max 100 and 400. It is strange how 3200 doesn't seem to have that same sort of property on that. Like, it, I wonder if 3200 is maybe, I don't know, slightly different on the emulsion. I don't know. I'm no film scientist here, but it does seem to not have that sort of strange or, you know, longer fixing time that the 100 and 400 has, but yeah, it's never stopped me. I do like T-Max 100 and 400. I don't shoot it as much, but man, it's hard to find a sharper, more grain-free black and white film than T-Max 100 and 400. So they have that going for them if that's the look you're looking for. But yeah, so Andre, man, that's great news, man, and that's kind of nice to have the inside scoop from a guy that's actually tested the product. So I knew I had you on this podcast for a reason. I knew it would pay off. So is there anything else you want to say about that before we move on to the next film big announcement?
No, just the shameless plug to, you know, when it finally does, you know, hit the CineStill online store and your favorite film retailers, you know, buy a bottle of it, you know, test it out, and definitely let me know what you guys think.
Awesome. Yeah, and ask him tons of questions, and just bother him all the time, and yeah.
Definitely. Whatever I can't answer, I'll pass on to the twins who are the real film nerds here.
Nice. So the next big item that has come out is a Kickstarter, and it is from the Pixelator. And Andre, I think you got maybe more information in front of you than I do, but let's talk about this Pixelator from Mr. Hamish, because it seems like an interesting product that could also, much like the Monobath from CineStill, could possibly help new film photographers or even some of us old folks in it, as far as like easing one of the one of the more pain in the asses about analog photography.
Hear, hear. I know it definitely is for me. But yeah, Pixelator is a friend of the show, Hamish Gill's innovative, low-cost, and effective solution for digitizing black and white or color negatives and transparencies. Reading that directly off of the Kickstarter page in front of me. But yeah, what Pixelator essentially is just a way of kind of mounting the negative in a holder that will, you know, fit 35mm, 120, or 4x5 film in between kind of a front plate and a diffuser panel that essentially just scatters the light and illuminates the negative evenly. And you can put that on top of a laptop screen, a tablet, a light table, or like an LED tracing pad. Or even Hamish has a little piece of it that that can connect to make a little stand, so that you can just put it in front of an open window or you know, any bright light source in order to properly illuminate the negative, and then take a picture of that with your smartphone, digital camera. If you do want to put it on a copy stand, that can work as well. It's essentially just trying to make it as sort of, you know, I hesitate to say modular, but make it as open as possible to how you want to set it up in order to quickly and easily digitize those negatives or slides for viewing online. And I'm personally super excited about it. At first, when I had only seen kind of hints and peeks at it and talking to Hamish offline, or online technically, I was pretty happy with my PacOn and my V600 as a scanning solution, but the more I think about it, the more I think that, you know, it does have a place for in my workflow, in that as soon as the negative is dry, let's say a roll of 120, for example, because the 35 I'll run through the PacOn, no problem.
Yeah.
But a roll of 120, for example, as soon as the negatives are dry, I can just, you know, take them off of the clothespins in my bathroom, hanging up in the shower, mount them in the Pixelator on top of my light table, and take a picture with my phone. I don't really own a digital camera that would really give me, well, I mean, I don't own a DSLR or mirrorless camera, period. So that option's off the table for me. But even just taking a picture of it with my phone and then, you know, bringing it into the editor just to flip the curves, to invert it, maybe change the contrast a little bit, and throw it up on Instagram or the negative positives film photography podcast Facebook group is something that I could really envision doing. And as I'm going to be taking another film photography class next semester, and I'm going to be forced to shoot some more 4x5, you know, I don't have to upgrade my scanner to something like a V700 or a V800, or, you know, split the 4x5 negative into two and stitch them in Photoshop. I can just mount it in the Pixelator, take a picture of it with my phone, because let's be honest, all I really want to do with a 4x5 negative is get something decent enough to throw online and then make a proper darkroom print. So I'm super excited about it, and I've been blabbering on, so I'm going to let Mike talk.
Well, I'm actually thinking about backing it, and mainly as just support for it. And I don't know if it works with my workflow that well, because my probably my best digital camera is a Pentax K10, which is about a decade old, and it's like 10 megapixels. So certainly my flatbed scanner is giving me better resolution than I would get out of like digitizing my film with a DSLR, because I don't have a modern one. And I also don't have a macro lens, which I think would be important for like trying to use the Pixelator with like a small film, like 35mm. But I'm probably going to back it, because I think it would be a quick way to, if nothing else, get a phone snap of the negative and just get it up on social media for that purposes. And plus, you know, I kind of want to support it, because I like to see where it goes after this, and or whatever plans he might have for it. And it's cheap. I mean, it's not like it's a big investment. It's not like this, you know, a couple hundred dollar thing you're trying to get into here. But yeah, I think I'm going to back it and just see how I can make it work with my workflow. And But right now it's like, you know, we bitch about scanning a lot, and but I'm getting to a point where it doesn't bother me maybe as much as it does some people. I've gotten my process down pretty quick, and I'm usually out here in the gutter man cave getting other things done while things are scanning. So maybe that's why it doesn't seem as tedious. I'm not just sitting here watching the scanner, but yeah.
Meanwhile, I think I'm getting more and more frustrated with scanning 35 millimeter. Like, thank God I have a pack on. Otherwise, I would never scan anything in that format. But for 120 and 4x5, you know, I've mentioned plenty of times that increasingly now I will just scan at around 800 DPI, which a lot of you are going to gasp at and be like, oh, that's so tiny. But everything that I post on the podcast that's medium format is 800 DPI, folks. So maybe instead of even doing that, which already takes me, you know, a decent bit of time to go ahead and cut the negatives, put them into the print file sleeves, and then take them out of the print file sleeves and put them into the stupid negative holders of the V600. I might honestly just, as soon as I get the roll off, like before even cutting it, just whack it through the pixelator on top of my little light table, and then just snap some pictures with my phone, invert the curves in Snapseed or even in the editor of like my actual like photos app in my phone, and plop them up on social media. And then if I ever do want to do anything with them, make my darkroom prints, you know, scan at 3200 DPI, like one or two frames in the V600, and just be happy with that.
Yeah, I think this thing is actually going to be a huge like godsend to like people that do 4x5. I think it's awesome for that, no question. And also, I think this could be a really, really kind of perfect solution to go with if you want to do a scan with your phone with like Abe's Film Lab app that is still,
absolutely.
Yeah, this could be a really perfect solution for that. Those two, that Film Lab app and the Pixelator, could kind of be a match made in heaven, truthfully. So,
well, you know what could be a true match made in heaven, Mike, is shooting some 4x5 film in something, you know, really kind of light and quick and easy to set up, like the Intrepid 4x5 or the Chroma 4x5 cameras. Develop in the Stearman Press SP445 developing tank with some CineStill DF96 monobath in, you know, 5 minutes or less. Hang that up to dry for, you know, about 10-15 minutes, and as soon as that negative is dry, pop it in the Pixelator and you know, scan it with the Film Lab app. I mean, all of these things, everything that I have just said, is all stuff that has come out in the past, you know, 3 or less years, which to me is kind of mind-boggling, especially for something like 4x5.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's an exciting week. You know, it's funny, after the kind of the banner year we had last year in 2017, 2018's not coming out of the gates too shabby. There's been a lot of good stuff happening this year too. So it doesn't look like this film train is slowing down anytime soon, and I love it. I love every bit of it. So, but anyway, Andre, I guess we should take another break and then come back for a last segment and wrap the shebang up. What do you think?
Sounds good.
Cool. All right, folks, we will be right back. Okay, folks, we are back from another little break, and Andre and I have had so much behind the scenes talk, and he's told me all the secrets of the film industry, and I can't divulge any of it. So he's threatened to kill me if I tell any of these super secrets. No, actually, he hasn't really divulged anything. I just kind of want to make you all think that I have the inside scoop on everything, but. But there is another little, not necessarily film news development going on, but I got this little notification in my Facebook that I had suddenly joined this group, or been put in this group, maybe against my will, and started getting notifications.
Oh, totally against my will, because I didn't accept anything. It was just like, you've been added by M.
So M from Emulsive, damn you, M. You have forced Andre and I into this group called, the Facebook group called the Film Camera Gas Factory. And I think there's some heavy hitters in the film community kind of involved with this conspiracy to try to get us all to buy more cameras and spend our money. But this is the last thing I need to be on, or actually anybody that is trying to limit their camera collection or maybe pare down their camera collection. You probably don't want to go to this page, but I am now a member of it. And damn you for it, but so
yeah, just to give you guys a view of the colorful, you know, cast of characters behind this group. Among the admins, we have friend / enemy of the show, M from Emulsive, Hamish Gill, of 35mmc, and most recently, as we just said, the creator of the Pixelator, Stephen Dowling of Cosmo Photo, Bellamy Hunt of Japan Camera Hunter, just you know, the usual suspects.
The usual culprits. The criminals of my wallet, I think, at this point. Because, yeah, it's definitely not a Facebook group page you want to go to if you're trying to save money, but yeah, it's a very entertaining group, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it. But yeah, you might want to approach with caution, I guess.
Look, but don't touch.
So yeah,
stay away from the eBay.
So I wonder, like a Facebook group like that, if like maybe I should put up some of my like really crappy cameras onto it and act like it's the best thing possible just to raise eBay prices so I can make some money off of them. I don't know. I think it's maybe a spin I could put on it, but to my advantage, I don't know.
That or just completely troll it, because there's a lot of nice stuff here, folks. There's a lot of Leicas, a lot of, you know, some high-end lenses and Hasselblads and Rolleiflexes. You know, Mike, if you should put some plastic fantastic in here, I think it'll definitely generate a good laugh.
Yeah.
Or, you know, anything Pentax, just to kind of show them what a garbage camera is.
Ah, come on now. That's a working man's camera. That's what that is. But but you know, it's funny. A lot of podcasts, they're out there, and sometimes some of them are gear focused, and a lot of podcasts are like, well, we're not going to talk about the gear. We want to talk about the process, and because we're going to be more highbrow. But let's face it, we're all gear nerds. Like, we could try to act like it's not a big part of our photography, but it is. Like, we love gear. I mean, I hats off to anybody that can get by with one or two cameras. I don't think there's a very large percentage of those guys out there, but you know, congrats if you can. But we all do love gear, and there's no question about it. And you know, this is definitely a Facebook group for those of us that do lust after cameras. No matter how many we collect, we continue to look for the next great thing. So there you go. There's your source for much gas in your future. It's like
What would be interesting is if the, you know, and I know that M's going to be listening to this, for example. It'd be interesting if the founders of this this wonderful group would consider potentially organizing some sort of kind of camera swap, so that if you have some acute gas-like symptoms and been lusting after a camera that you've been seeing on the pictures in the group, if you can, you know, manage to temporarily trade and swap cameras with somebody else. And I know that we've previously talked about this. Stephen Byrne was at some point putting together an Excel spreadsheet to kind of, or a Google Sheets spreadsheet to facilitate that. Steven, if you're out there, you know, let's try to hop back on that. But it would be interesting because a lot of these kind of rarer cameras or ones that, you know, you've always kind of wanted to get your hands on, it might be an interesting thing to consider, you know, if we could somehow facilitate a temporary, you know, trade and swap program. Because, I mean, hey, I would love to get my hands on, you know, something like a black Nikon F2 or or you know, a Hasselblad 503. Yeah. Who knows?
A lot of Pentaxes you'd like to get your hands on, I'm sure. So, you know.
No, I couldn't be further from the truth.
So I'm kind of considering this Facebook group as like the pinto beans of film photography. So, because once you partake in it, you will have a lot of gas. And so they are the.
I was wondering where you were going with that. And I'm glad to say that I'm just as disappointed as I thought I was going to be.
Oh, come on. You know, beans, good for your heart. The more you eat, the more you fart.
No.
Beans, the magical fruit. The more you eat, the more you toot.
I apologize, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, maybe it's
nothing that should be surprising at this point, though.
All right, so I guess maybe we should wrap this episode up before it devolves anymore. But Andre, where can people see your work? Where can people see your 9 photos?
People can see my 9 photos at Andre on Film. However, with something like the Pixelator, you know, the process of getting film onto my stupid Instagram account will be much, you know, easier, since I will probably be doing everything with my phone.
There you go.
But yes, on Andre at Andre on Film on Instagram, as well as the Negative Positives Film Photography Podcast Facebook group.
Nice. You can see my photography on Instagram at Gutterman Photo, on Facebook at Mike Gutterman Photography. You can email this program at guttermanphoto@gmail.com. And obviously join the Facebook group, the Negative Positives Film Photography Podcast Facebook group. All right. That is the end of this midweek episode. So glad that Andre was able to join us for this. We're going to wrap it up and end it. And this is the end, folks. So everybody stay positive.
And shoot some cool film photos and then develop them in the Cinestill DF96 monograph.
All right, folks, we will see you very soon. Take care.
Bye.